May it please the court. My name is Debbie Durban, and I represent the appellant here, HSBC Finance Company. And this is a religious discrimination claim where the plaintiff, Mr. Miller, claims that when he was an employee of HSBC, HSBC failed to accommodate his desire to attend two church meetings per week. The plaintiff also had a claim that HSBC treated him differently because of his religion. At the trial in the case, the jury came back with a verdict in favor of HSBC on the disparate treatment claim, but in favor of plaintiff on the failure to accommodate claim. HSBC is appealing the failure to accommodate claim on several grounds. The first ground is we don't believe the plaintiff was able to produce sufficient evidence showing he had an adverse employment action.
Ms. Durbin, I take it your contention is that as a matter of law, he was not terminated.
That is correct.
That's your issue number one.
That is your correct.
Okay, but he testified that he was terminated, and the jury apparently believed that he was terminated, and his papers showed that he was terminated. So how do you get around all that?
Well, Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree that the paper showed he was terminated. I certainly think—
Didn't your client process him out as if it was a performance-based termination?
Yes, Your Honor, they did, but only after the plaintiff had called up his manager and said, I am not coming back to work.
Well, but that would have been a voluntary quit.
And that—
Right? I mean, the papers would have reflected that, I think, as a voluntary quit, would it not?
Well, it would, except this was a situation, I would say, a humanitarian decision.
And we see that often, and juries are told that that's what it was, and then the jury says, no, we don't think so. So I'm not sure where you go from. If you can't convince the jury, I'm not sure you even have the real opportunity to convince us, because we're not the jury.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the jury didn't work. I think the jury was confused. I believe that they think that the HSBC did not terminate. I mean, that they did not accommodate the plaintiff, but I'm not sure that they understood the decision on the termination itself. There's just no evidence he wasn't terminated.
But he testified at Joint Appendix 58. He was talking with Mr. DePriest. He said, are you going to terminate me? He said, yes.
And
we shook hands, et cetera, et cetera.
And, Your Honor, I certainly don't disagree that the plaintiff believed he was probably terminated.
Well, no, he didn't say that he believed it. He said that Mr. DePriest said yes.
But Mr. DePriest could not terminate him. He didn't have the authority to do so.
Well,
he was not terminated.
What does that make? He was the regional sales manager, and he told this man that he was fired, according to, if you believe Mr. Miller.
Well, what Mr. DePriest said was, according to Mr. Miller, which we certainly need to believe for the purposes of this argument, is that, are you going to terminate me? And Mr. DePriest said, yes. Well, that's a statement of future intent, I would say, not that he was terminated.
But
he didn't say
he
was terminated.
Then they got up and took hands, and he said, I appreciate, Mr. DePriest said, I appreciate what you've done. And my response was, I hear you, but I don't believe you.
Well, Mr. DePriest was sending Mr. Miller home for the day, so he could, and as you read Mr. DePriest's testimony, he explains he was sending him home for the day. He didn't know whether he was going to be terminated. He probably thought he might be because he thought there were 3 days a week that Mr. Miller could work, and Mr. Miller had refused to do so. But he was going to call his HR division manager and check to see what options were out there. Was Mr. Miller going to be terminated? Was Mr. Miller going to be able to retire? Was there another accommodation HR would want them to offer Mr. Miller? I mean, the evidence is just very clear that Mr. DePriest could not on his own terminate Mr. Miller's employment.
These are good arguments, jury. But our problem is that the jury haven't made a decision. It seems like to me, I think as Judge Davis's question indicated, the only way you can fail this part of your argument, we can determine as a matter of law that there was not a termination. If there's it doesn't matter what we would have believed, if there's sufficient evidence that a reasonable jury could have concluded there was a termination. And that's very difficult for you to prevail. You can use your time however you want to, but you may want to assume there was sufficient evidence just for purposes of argument for a termination and move on to some other things. That's up to you.
Well, certainly. And I will move on to the second element that the second part of a failure to accommodate claim. If Mr. Miller proved that he had been terminated, then the burden shifts to HSBC to prove that they had indeed offered him a reasonable accommodation, which Mr. Miller refused to accept. And I would tell you that the evidence is there. We offered him a reasonable accommodation that permitted him to come back to work, work his same, it's the same job, the same benefits, the same terms and conditions. The only difference would be that he didn't have to work on a night that conflicted with his religious meetings.
Now, the plaintiff's, as I understand it, argument response there is that if you accept the proposition that there was sufficient evidence to prove termination, then there couldn't be an accommodation, as it's acknowledged in this phase of employment law. There could have been a reinstatement, but there could not have been an accommodation to allow a Tenth Circuit case to do that. And there isn't a whole lot of law out there, but it seems like to me in the instructions 9 and 4 that went to the jury, there was a distinction made between an accommodation and a reinstatement. And I think that's something that you need to address, because if you can't accommodate after you terminate, then that may be too much for a jury to grasp, but I don't know that we can settle that part. But if you can't accommodate after you terminate, then you're going to have to explain to us what was wrong with these instructions.
Well, as we objected at the trial, we believe that the instruction given from that Tenth Circuit case, Toledo versus Cisco Noble, I believe, that was a wrong instruction and that did not reflect the law in the Fourth Circuit. And, in fact, there's law in this Fourth Circuit from the Dennis versus County of Fairfax case that states that an employer who takes corrective remedial action after being put on notice of an alleged discriminatory act, it is not liable for discrimination, as long as they plaintiff there didn't suffer any detriment, and Mr. Miller didn't suffer any detriment. Within 3 hours maximum, he had been told that he could come back to work. He had agreed to come back to work and to work a schedule that didn't conflict
with
his.
But the jury was instructed, was it not, that they could take that into consideration in terms of damages, and that could consider it to support their claim that he didn't suffer any damages. They were able to do that, weren't they?
Well, they were, but they were two conflicting, I would argue, two conflicting jury instructions as to the reinstatement.
Why were they conflicting? You know, I've got the two of them. I've been reading the two of them last night and this morning again. And why do they necessarily conflict? I'm having a little trouble with that.
Well, I believe the instruction that came from the Supreme Court case, the Ford Motor Company case, states that an employee who rejects a unconditional offer of reinstatement, loses back pay unless there are special circumstances. I would argue
if the jury here didn't believe that it was an unconditional offer. I mean, the plaintiff argued that it was conditional, that they were going to, it was basically an illusory offer because they were going to can the guy anyway.
Well, a couple of arguments with that. First of all, I would say that Mr. Miller knew way before he received this offer of accommodation or reinstatement that he was subject to termination. He knew that back the first of the month when he had his final written warning, and he agreed that that warning was correct. He knew the company policy. He knew if he hadn't made his goal, he would be subject to termination. Nothing said he would automatically be terminated. He knew that.
Right, but then the jury also had in front of it the testimony of Mr. Miller that when they called him back and offered him to work Friday night, they also said, you can be terminated at the end of the month, and slammed the phone down.
Well, sir,
and the jury could have believed it.
But unconditional, according to the Supreme Court in that Ford Motor Company case, unconditional is an offer that does not require the plaintiff to give up anything. And Mr. Miller here didn't give up, wouldn't have given up anything to have come back to work. He would have been put back in the same position. He wasn't waiving any claim. He wasn't giving up anything. It was a reasonable offer of accommodation and a reasonable, unconditional offer of reinstatement, however you want to take it. I would still argue that you can't accommodate an employee after an alleged discriminatory act, such as a termination. And that is the precedent, again, from that Dennis versus County of Fairfax case.
Well, I think the plaintiff takes a position based on the 10th Circuit case that as a matter of law, there can't be an accommodation after termination.
And, you know, that 10th Circuit case is very different from this case. In that case, it was an employee that had not been hired. It was three or four months after he had not been hired. They were mediating before the Human Affairs Commission in, I'm not sure what state, Arizona or Nevada. And the plaintiff was being asked to waive any claims he had against the employer. He wasn't being offered back pay. The plaintiff in that 10th Circuit case had a great detriment. And it's just very different than what the case is here.
I think that's very, very fair, Ms. Durbin. But as a matter of logic, and frankly, common sense, you can't accommodate a terminated employee, right? And in fact, the term terminated employee is an oxymoron, isn't it? Because a terminated employee is an ex-employee, right? So as a matter of logic, it seems to me you have to first reinstate an employee, a former employee, before an employer can reasonably accommodate that now reinstated employee. I mean, wouldn't a juror be perfectly entitled to puzzle that out in that fashion?
Well, and thus, that's why we have both arguments in the alternative.
Of course.
If he was terminated, then we did offer him reinstatement. But there is case law, and not that I could find from this circuit, that said terminations or threats of terminations, even terminations that last just a short period and don't cause a detriment to the employee, don't count as an adverse employment action.
Well, it goes to damages, and you got that instruction.
Well, I think the instruction, though, was contradictory, and even the district court noted when he gave the second instruction that it was different than his first instruction. So what is the jury to think when they receive the two instructions? I think it confused them.
What exactly is, I'm looking at Joint Appendix page 365, and then again at 399. What exactly is contradictory?
I believe what the instruction that the plaintiff had advocated there expressed a reasonable standard that the employee can refuse an offer of reinstatement if it's reasonable. And I would tell you that
you mean if the rejection is
reasonable, then it doesn't stop the accrual of back pay. I don't think that was the holding from the Supreme Court. In that case, the Ford Motor Company case, I think, is instructive. The three plaintiffs there had an offer of reinstatement, but it didn't include retroactive seniority. And they thought it should have retroactive seniority from the time they were denied the job. And the court there said, no, I mean, you're not entitled to anything better than you had. You know, that's not a special circumstance. So I think the court
reasonably rejects an offer of reinstatement. You're saying that does not go to litigation? I'm kind of confused.
What the instruction that the court gave at the plaintiff's request was a reasonable rejection of an offer of reinstatement does not affect back pay damages. And I am arguing that I don't believe that is the standard that the Supreme Court brought down in the Ford Motor Company case, that it took special circumstances. Now, granted, I'm not sure the court explained those special circumstances, but if you look at the facts of that Ford Motor Company case, it is different than, I mean, these ladies believe they had a reasonable reason for not accepting it. They weren't getting the retroactive seniority, and the court rejected that.
Okay. Why, although, why can't you reconcile these instructions by saying that plaintiff's instruction 4, there's no effect on damages if the rejection of the offer was reasonable, okay? And defendant's instruction says only special circumstances will permit the rejection. Well, the jury could then say, well, if the rejection was unreasonable, it's a special exception that will permit the rejection. Isn't that what naturally flows from reading those two together?
Well, I would argue that the plaintiff's instruction in number 4 is a permissive type instruction. You know, if the plaintiff just decides it's not reasonable, then it's not going to affect damages. And I believe that the language from the Ford Motor Company is much stronger. It's more mandatory language that you can't reject it unless there are some special exceptional circumstances that would cause that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We've got some time left for rebuttal. Brooks.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. This is an unusual case to a certain extent, certainly in my experience, in that we have some insight from the record as to what the jury was actually thinking in this case. We do, as the court has noted, have Mr. Miller's own testimony that he was terminated at that May 17th meeting and that there was no doubt about it, including to the point his manager shook his hand and thanked him for his work. But that same manager, Mr. DePries, testified that his employment ended in that meeting, and the only thing left to resolve was whether it be processed as a termination or retirement, because Mr. Miller was in his late 60s and he knew he had a retirement option. The jury, during deliberations, asked specifically to hear that testimony again, because they were trying to understand whether Mr. Miller was sent home for the day, as the company was contending, or whether he was actually told by Mr. DePries that he was terminated. So they heard that testimony again. On a second occasion, the jury came back in its deliberations and said, we would like to also hear and understand the company policy, about that company policy, that in order to be terminated for job abandonment, and the human resources manager said that was the triggering event. He abandoned his job. And the jury wanted to hear again about the policy, said that in order to terminate for job abandonment under company policy, the employee had to be sent a letter and given 3 days to return. And it was undisputed that did not happen in this case. He was immediately terminated. And it was immediately after the jury received that additional information that it rendered its verdict. And I do believe, to submit to this court, that all the issues that have been raised were really issues for the jury to decide. Was it the strongest case? Did the jury have rule for the company? Absolutely. But they did not. It was their responsibility, it was their job to decide this case. Summary judgment had been denied on these same arguments. It was put to the jury and they decided. I find nothing inconsistent with the jury instructions. The general instruction from the Ford Motor case in the Supreme Court is very generic. It doesn't get into details of what is reasonable, what are special circumstances. And if ever a case called for some further explanation, this was it. Because again, the facts were, he was terminated at the meeting. He was subsequently called on the telephone where he was told, well, you can come back and be terminated in 2 weeks. And then the manager, whose voice was angry anyway, slammed the phone down. Now, counsel says, and they've argued throughout, that, well, Mr. Miller was on, had some performance issues. He knew that. And as the district court said when it heard arguments on the post-hearing motions, well, if he knew that, why did he raise it in that conversation? If it was not intended to be a threat, why did he raise it in that conversation if what he was doing was inviting him to come back unconditionally to work and that it was reasonable? So we find that the jury instructions, one, additional instructions were necessary, and the ones the court offered were consistent with Ford Motor case and simply expounded upon that.
Mr. Brooks?
Yes, sir.
How did, if you know, how did the jury calculate the damages here? They weren't really damages. They were lost wage.
They were lost wage.
Was that a pretty sort of a easy calculation for the jury based on what you offered?
The back pay was a very easy calculation because it was simply a matter of computing his pay, taking out his interim earnings. And the company had actually folded all of its Columbia operations during the pendency of this lawsuit.
I see.
So the back pay had stopped. So we were dealing with a definitive number.
Just arithmetic.
It was arithmetic, and nobody has ever contested that arithmetic.
Now, you did ask for compensatory damages, however.
We did ask for compensatory damages.
And that was argued and presented to the jury, and the jury in its wisdom decided, oh, we're going to limit this award to back pay.
That's correct.
We're going to limit it to the reasonable accommodation claim and not the discrimination.
That's correct, John. It was is the back pay purely, and it was mathematical. The only dispute about the mathematics is the one issue they raised on appeal, that the court used its discretion in using the state statutory rate for prejudgment interest, and I think the Fourth Circuit has affirmed several different cases where that's how the court approached it. So I think that was certainly fair under the context. She mentioned the Fairfax case, and want to make sure the points we make in our brief are fully understood by the court. Fairfax was a harassment case. And as this court is well aware, the Supreme Court has adopted an entirely different standard for liability in harassment cases. If the company can show it has a policy, which this company did, and there's allegations of harassment, it needs to be reported, and then the company gets the opportunity to correct. And if the company takes reasonable corrective action, then there's no liability. That standard has no application whatsoever, I would submit, in a case of pure discrimination. And it really was a failure to accommodate. Mr. Miller was terminated because the company would not insisted that he work a schedule that conflicted with his religious beliefs. Now, we argued also that the company engaged in classic disparate treatment discrimination, and that young female employees were permitted to not work the same schedule because of their child care issues, but he was not given that same accommodation for his religious needs or beliefs. We argued that that was discrimination in the classic sense. So it was two issues we posed to the jury. That's why the court adopted a jury form that presented both, and there was nothing inconsistent. In fact, the jury was told you can find for the plaintiff on one or both claims or neither, and that would be your option under the circumstances. On the damage issue, you got the company seeking judgment as a matter of law on liability and on damages. As we set forth in our brief, we would take the position that that argument on damages has been waived. It was not presented to the district court in its motion. The company contends that the plaintiff has waived that, but not objecting to it, raising it during the post trial motions, but I cannot find anywhere where the company had contended at any point up to coming before this court that there was a termination that subsequently was rescinded or that it asked for judgment on the matter of law on the issue of damages. The company never conceded the liability issue. The company doesn't concede it today. It still adheres to its position that Mr. Miller was not terminated, that he voluntarily abandoned his job or resigned. And I would suggest we believe the record supports the jury's finding that he was terminated as he contended, based on not just his testimony, which alone would be sufficient, but also the testimony of defendant's own witness in the matter. I have some additional time. I would be happy and pleased to answer any questions the court may have, but I've made the points I'd like to make this morning as well as those that are made in the brief.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Durbin, you have some time in rebuttal.
Thank you. A couple of corrections I'd like to make. First, on the Fairfax versus County of the Dennis versus County of Fairfax case, that's not a harassment case. It was a racial discrimination case. In that case, the plaintiff claimed that he had been treated differently than a white employee because he had been given a written warning. He'd had some type of argument with the white employee, and he'd been given a written warning, and he had received a bad evaluation, and he thought that was disparate treatment on the basis of his race. It was a race discrimination case. Now, the court here used the harassment analysis to come to the ruling that when a employer takes immediate corrective remedial action after being put on notice of a discriminatory event, then that employer is not liable for that event.
But that's an existing employee as opposed to a fired employee, right?
That's correct.
How does that lend support to your position?
Well, I would contend that Mr. Miller, had he been terminated, was reinstated.
So it all comes down to whether he was fired or not, doesn't it?
Well, if he was fired, then he was reinstated. So he became an employee.
Reinstated without your consent. How can you be reinstated as an employee? We have a voluntary system of labor in this country. How can you be reinstated without your consent?
But he did consent. He, on the telephone call that afternoon, he consented to come back to work the next day. He said he would be back at that next day. He would work that new schedule. Everything was copacetic. It was not till the next morning that he called his manager back and said, I've changed my mind. I'm not coming back. So he was reinstated, maybe only for a night, until he then voluntarily resigned his employment and said he wasn't going to take it. But he agreed.
Excuse me, Ms. Durbin.
Yes.
Have you preserved the issue of damages by making a timely motion? And if so, can you point us to the page in the joint appendix where you did that? Because I'm looking at page 272 of the joint appendix, and it's very clear that you moved for judgment as to punitive damages. But as Mr. Brooks suggested, I haven't seen, I mean, it came up during the trial, certainly, but with respect to the motion at the close of the plaintiff's case.
I would agree that it was not included in the 50A motion, but it was included in our Rule 50B motion, and it wasn't objected to by the plaintiff. And I would also agree that the issue of reinstatement came up many times during the trial. So the plaintiff and the court was on notice of what we thought the effect reinstatement would have.
But is it sufficient to move at the close of all the evidence if you haven't moved the close of the plaintiff's case in chief to preserve that issue?
I believe that the court doesn't require a technical compliance with Rule 50A, and there's a case that I think states that. If you think it's that Singer v. Dungan, that as long as the rule, what the rule needs, as long as the plaintiff is on notice of what the issues are, you don't have to technically comply.
And what I'm suggesting is that by moving as to punitive damages and expressly not moving as to compensatory damages or back pay,
well,
that seems to take the latter out of the case.
Well, we moved because we didn't want the punitive damage issue, of course, to go to the jury. We knew the other one was but we knew we were going probably. But I would tell you that we did move in our Rule 50B motion, and the plaintiff didn't object to it. So our contention would be that's
your hook
waived
on the Rule 50B motion, and that the plaintiff failed to object to it. Is that what obviates waiver in this case?
Yes, sir. That's my understanding. I would also argue that we put the plaintiff on notice, so we. During the trial of the effect of reinstatement, it was brought up in the jury instructions. It was brought up in our closing. And then we brought it up in our Rule 50B motion. The plaintiff did not object to it, and so we contend that's waived. Quickly, just to address in my 19 seconds left, the plaintiff brought up job abandonment. I don't think job abandonment, anybody ever said that they considered him to have abandoned his job. They considered him to have resigned his job. I think the testimony of Mr. DePriest has been mischaracterized. He didn't agree that he had terminated plaintiff. He agreed that he was going to call HR and find out what options were available. So that statement that Mr. DePriest agreed is not a correct statement if you read his testimony in whole. And I believe that's it, unless you have any more questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We'll come down and recounsel and then take a very brief recess.